I only see the library mentioned once, right down here on the bottom.
Okay.
What you have to understand is we have rural mindsets out
no,
here
I
too.
Know.
Yeah. And
I know.
It's a lot different than
yeah.
the rest of the country probably.
No. And I mean personally I never signed it.
Yeah.
I've never that so I don't know.
Okay.
So we were at Guest Ranch, and then you
stopped it.
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
So
okay.
you were gonna start to just talk about being here, like I think.
Yeah. Okay, now that I was
interrupted. Now that you're, can you remember where you were?
Now that we've had a really sort
okay,
of
the, you,
energizing.
You, what started that up is you mentioned about the urban
yes.
metropolitan people.
Yeah.
I will take it as not understanding what's going on out here, and hopefully that they are interested in what's going on out here. And so that's where I started off with. We
okay.
used to run the Guest Ranch for
okay.
18 years. We've retired from that.
So this land?
Yeah, those
this
cabins
property.
You saw coming in here, mm-hmm. that's where
right.
we have people from all over the world here.
Okay.
And one of the things I was going to bring up about your point of the urban people is we had okay. on occasion... people sign up for coming out here and coming from downtown Portland and coming out here and absolutely were so out of place, so
yes.
felt so
yeah.
misplaced that they would turn around and leave.
And go,
really?
Yeah. I'm not surprised because
yeah.
I can tell you
and,
that.
And I mean, they just, one gal I remember, they didn't even make it here. They turned around right down there and took off and they finally called back.
Because they were on a gravel road or something.
Well, that, it happened to be getting towards nighttime.
Oh.
And anyway, he called from Paisley then and told us that his wife was scared. She was not comfortable out here. She wanted to go home. And so that was my point where I was going with that. So now it's your turn. to continue the interview.
It's interesting to being so out of place, like they're just not used to open spaces, I guess.
It's dark.
They probably grew up in downtown Portland where mm-hmm. people all around them and that gave them that security or something.
Right.
And then they come out here and they're by themselves in an environment they're not familiar with. And so there was a fear build up and...
Yeah.
That's all I can say. I
well, even the ones that were comfortable had a hard time gearing down. I mean,
oh yeah,
they would almost vibrate on the deck for about two hours, and then finally they kind of got into the ebb and flow of this kind of life, and they just absolutely loved it.
We gave up on trying to get them to leave their cell phones and laptops at home. that was their lifestyle. And you know, you take that away from them, and they can't give it up. They just that's something we don't understand.
One of the reasons that we kept up on the Guest Ranch for 18 years is that we enjoyed bringing that kind of a slow-paced ebb and flow to their lives that were so different, you know, in their everyday life. They were just diametrically opposed to what we are here, and showing them the places around here that were. Where they could kind of commune, you know, and enjoy life. So that's one of my reasons for doing it.
Where are some of the places you would show them, where you would take them?
Well, we have a whole system of trails on the Forest Service here, plus on the ranch. And we leased out riding horses, and I'd take them on trail rides. And then we'd get way out there, and we'd some of the pictures that I sent in and talked about... Let's see, what one of them was up at our upper meadow where we would ride to, and okay, let's just back up just a little bit here.
Okay.
One of the purposes of the Guest Ranch was for education. As we mentioned before, the city people, the urban people don't understand what's going on out here. Why are we doing what we're doing sometimes on the landscape? And it was an opportunity to have them come out in a casual atmosphere, sit down, talk about it, get on horses, ride through something we were doing out there, and being able to explain to them why this was happening. And that I think, was probably our primary success mm-hmm. Of stuff that happened with the urban people. And people from internationally, all over the world. We had, I don't know how many people from, you know, how many countries we had people here, but it was a considerable number of countries, Europe and Africa and South America and Australia, Japan, you know. Amazingly, no Chinese. I don't know why, but we were told that we'd be inundated by them. We never had a single one. So anyway, but it gave us that opportunity for education. And we like to call ourselves stewards of the land. And it's my personal belief that anytime you have the privilege of ownership of land, you need to take care of it. And when you release it, whether if you're passing or selling it, it needs to be in as good or better condition than you purchased it. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we call ourselves stewards of land. We take care of it. If we don't take care of it, it's not beneficial to us. So, you know, so that's what we're trying to pass on to these people.
Were there some common misconceptions that people had that coming that you were able to kind of
talk, I think, them, yeah, one thing you notice, and you can see some right out there, people cutting juniper. Mm-hmm. Why we're doing that? And a lot of people say you're cutting all the trees. Well, juniper is a native species, but it is highly it's not very susceptible to fire. And in the old, before white men came here, fires, according to the scientists, covered this, every part of this ground every 35 years. Mm-hmm. And that's why juniper was held back to its natural firebreak areas, rim rocks, high rocky areas, poor soil conditions where there wasn't a ladder fuel to get to it, mm-hmm. and that type of thing. And so when we started controlling the fires, the juniper started spreading out. Juniper is very, very aggressive about getting water from the ground. And it transpires, some people say up to 50 gallons a day into the atmosphere. Some people say more than that. But and when in doing that, it takes the moisture, because it's got a very sophisticated root system, way bigger than the tree is. And most trees, their roots go out about as far as your branches do. Junipers are 4 to 5 times further out and deep. And so they're highly competitive with the native species, other native species, grasses mainly, your bunch grasses and stuff like that, which are very crucial for sage grouse, which is, and so we've got the all the feed for the wildlife is disappearing because of the junipers in it. And so after 150 years, man's finally realized what's happening. So we start taking the juniper off to try to influence. Well, maybe almost too late for that, but because some of the native species, the bunch grasses especially, are going bye-bye. And so what replaces them is the annual grasses. And we have 3 major annual grasses here that are not native: cheatgrass, ventinata, and Medusa head rye. And so they're the first ones to kind of come back in. And they, according to scientists, kind of do a trick on the soil and make it not as quite as healthy for the native grasses to live in. So they take over. And so juniper has caused a second. Not only has man brought these species into the country, but that they are a major problem now. So we're battling the native grasses annual grasses, not native grasses, that are not native. And so, you know, all this, by taking juniper, you not only help wildlife by getting some of their feedback, but you're also creating more water available to the existing soil. Now,
Would you say so are the bunch grasses like better for animals than the annual? Like what?
Bunch grasses have a deeper root system and they hold the soil better, so they help prevent erosion. Mm-hmm. Where your annual's got a root system about that big, you can grab them and pull them, and the roots come out. Bunch grasses, you could pull them out if you wanted to.
Okay.
So they're better at stabilizing the soil.
Okay.
And better feed. Most of the annual grasses, the ones I mentioned anyway, other than cheatgrass, are not palatable to wildlife, livestock. Cheatgrass is palatable in its very early stages, but it matures very early. In fact, if you look out, cheatgrass is always turning red out there. Mm-hmm. That's too late. They won't eat it anymore. Mm-hmm. Unless forced to. And usually, if you try to force them to eat it, then they pick on the native species first, eat them clear down before they'll move on to the cheatgrass. So that defeats the purpose. So.
Yeah. And then you said a long time ago that every part of this land was different.
That's according to what I've
every
heard.
Every 35 years.
Every 35 years, just about every part. I'm not sure. The forest, probably not. But this desert country, mm-hmm. rangerland country. According to a scientist from OSU, he made that statement, and I heard it from him. Mm-hmm. And very coincidentally, junipers do not produce any seed for 35 years. Oh. And so it's kind of a weird thing there. But
were there any other major misconceptions that you remember talking through?
Okay, this one's probably rooted in truth from way back, and that's overgrazing. Most of our neighbors in this area that run cattle or livestock are very well educated, and they understand about overgrazing now, and that it's very rare that you see situations where that happens anymore. But that's the stigma that we have been put on us. And so to convince people that, hey, we're not. It's actually beneficial. Okay, here's a relation to fire and grazing. There wasn't, in this area here, there wasn't the mass herds. Like in the plains, there's the buffalo that went all over and grazed all the grasses down. Mm-hmm. And so it reduced the amount of fuels for fire prevention in a way. And over here we didn't have those massive herds, and so it was fire that, you know, these grasses grew and they got mature and they would catch and it would burn. Where in the plains it didn't burn so much. Now the grazing app actually kind of replicates what the fire did back in then. But again, at one point in time in our history, overgrazing was the thing that happened, and so that was too much. You know, and that was every year, you know. Mm-hmm. Every day they go out there and graze that, where fire was every 35 years, you know. So
you were talking about your upper meadow. Mm-hmm. What is it like? Where is that, and what can you
describe what it's like? It's to the southwest. It's a camas meadow. It was Native Americans loved it up there. There is evidence of they had actually encampments there during the camas season, because camas root was one of their major staples for carbohydrates, and they'd go out and dig the roots and dry them. And we found pestles and all kinds of stuff up there, and so. Get your iPad and get that picture of that. So I'll show you what a camas meadow looks like in full bloom.
Does it have is this area of the land have a name, or is this just a certain area on your property that is really? Like if I tried to, I don't know. There's so many places around here that have names.
Well, this is Clover Flat.
Okay.
This basin right here.
And then the upper meadow of Clover Flat is what you're talking
about. Well, that's not actually in Clover Flat. That's it's a little small basin that used to be, I think, a playa.
Yeah.
I think it was a lake originally. And it just over thousands of years, it just, you know, vegetated in. And finally the vegetation and sod got above what the water table was. And so there is every spring we have water setting out there. And that's why we have so much camas in there, because it is still well irrigated. And but then the, you know, as a actual lake, it's disappeared. We have a couple instances up to, well, one actually on our property is another little lake that actually does for about 7 months of the year is actually a lake, and it's getting to that point where going to start the water will go away. I mean, it's down there. It's just not above the surface. So but that's what Coyote Meadow is.
And that's name. Coyote Meadow?
Coyote Meadow. That's the name of the upper meadow.
Oh, okay. So it's a camas meadow,
it's a camas
but the
meadow.
Name of it is Coyote Meadow.
Right.
And then this lake you're talking about, has the water level been different like throughout time, or you just have seen it like go lower throughout time?
Well, each year, you know, it comes up in the winter after the spring thaws, and then it goes down for it soaks in the ground and evaporates, and then it gets in. It's got a very grassy bottom to it. Mm-hmm. And it's just in the stages of getting to what Coyote Meadow is. So.
You mean to, but it would fill up again in the winter.
Oh yeah, at this point in time, it will.
Okay, I thought you were saying
it may be another 100 years,
right,
before it doesn't do that anymore.
Yeah,
you know, that's one of the things that humans, as in general, have a concept that their lifetime is forever.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And when we're talking about old growth forests or something like that, or any tree as far as that goes. Trees have a lifetime. Every living thing has a lifetime. It just so happens that there, some of them are 1,000 years, and we're only 100 years, you know. But when humans put their concept of forever again, they relate their forever to what a tree is forever, and it doesn't wash. One thing that's come up here very recently is Lake Abert up here. We're having a lot of controversy about going dry. Well, it's historically gone dry a number of different times, and it all has to do with the weather. But Oregon Field Guide came out here and did a little half hour segment, or 15 minute segment, I guess it was, on when all the political stuff was going on about it and when it was dry, which was the first time it's been dry since 1930s. But anyway, there was a guy that had been doing this brine shrimp fishing on it, and he's guiding the field guide photographers out there talking, and he says, "In my lifetime, I have never seen it like this." What does that mean in the relationship of what the world is? 4.5 billion years, we're nothing. But that comment over TV meant everything. That was just catastrophic, because it was forever. I mean, in forever, it's never happened like this before. That's not true. You know, so that's a misconcept we get for people that don't know. Mm-hmm. And so
you have records of that throughout.
We had a guy that was still alive that walked across Abert Lake in 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
There was no water in.
Yeah.
But that was 2 years ago. Well, yeah, 2 years ago that happened.
Mm-hmm.
You go look at Lake Abert now, it's about 2/3 full.
Mm-hmm.
One good winter filled it halfway up. And that's what this country's about. It's water is a big issue. We have our good years and we have our bad years. This year's going to be another drought year. Last year was a good year. The year before that was a drought year. And we're in a period of drought right now. And so, that's a misconception I was getting at, is people don't understand anything beyond their own lives, I guess is the best way to put it.
Have you been in these seasons of drought the whole time you've been here, like indifferent, they just come and go, is that?
Since we've been here, we've noticed that there's been a gradual decrease of water. We've been here 21 years now, going on 22. And the first winter we were here had a 100-year flood. That meadow during was almost a third full of water.
Whoa.
Flowing down that creek stream bed. It was so much water coming down that winter. We had a Chinook. We had a high snowpack, had a Chinook. Everything just came down.
Oh, yeah.
And the next year it was dry. That's the way it is here. Flash circumstances. Well,
yeah. Where were you before you moved here?
I was originally from Burns, but I lived on my granddad's ranch. Mm-hmm. And then he also had a ranch in Western Oregon in the Corvallis area. It was northwest of Corvallis in the Coast Range. And that's when he sold that ranch, we moved. And I spent a good share of my life over there. And then came back over here.
What are some other, you talked about the upper meadow, what are some other places around here that are really significant to you, or either things that are important to you have happened, or things that are especially beautiful?
Yeah, from a kind of, I guess you'd call it a recreation standpoint, it wasn't totally recreation because our business was guiding guests around. I talked about the trail system onto the west of us here that runs clear through this area. It gets on top of the ridge up there. And as I mentioned, I don't know if you've seen the pictures undoubtedly that we sent in. I submitted too.
I haven't seen them.
I'll show you to Anna.
Okay. Anyway,
yeah.
I was supposed to put a little blip about what it was and one thing and where we would take people if to show them Lake County. And I mentioned up there on that ridge where you can stand on the ridge. It's a bare ridge, relatively bare. You can look to the west and you see the forest, the Shibokan River Basin. It's just green, everything. You turn around 180 degrees and you're looking out over the desert.
Mm-hmm.
You see Apert Rim. You see forever that way because it's just sagebrush and rim rocks. And so that shows the diversity of Lake County.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is down here. And so
yeah.
That's a very significant part to me. I love it up there. I like to take people up there.
Does it have a name? Did you mention it?
Well, there's a ridge. It's Morgan Butte to Round Mountain, I guess is what you'd call it.
Yeah.
Myers Butte. Oh.
Okay. What's your favorite time of year in this area?
Pretty much right now.
I deleted it.
That one?
I sent it to Janelle, and I deleted it.
No, not the one you just took.
Oh.
The one we have on our, that we sent the picture of.
I don't have it.
You know what?
It's on that one right there.
Oh, well, I can't find it. I can show it.
We've got three iPads. We can just
What?
Well, I keep upgrading. And the other one doesn't quit working. So,
right.
This is a little hole for, like, recording.
You can, if you get a microphone, you can use it that way. Yeah, you have to get a special microphone because just any microphone won't work.
Okay.
But if you look up like podcast microphone or something,
okay.
then yeah, they're not that expensive and they work really well. So what is it about this time of year? Like,
okay, the wildflowers, yeah. the green here in another. This is the 1st of June. Another month and a half. That'll start. People say it start turning brown, but I call it golden.
Mm-hmm.
The grasses will start maturing and it starts turning brown, and then you have all the wildflowers in full boar bloom right now.
What kind of wildflowers do you have around here?
We got lots.
Yeah, some of the favorites.
Indian paintbrush. There's a little bouquet I picked this morning. There's vetch. And there's all kinds of little daisy things. Phlox is really cool. There's a couple different colors, and it's almost gone now. But there's just all kinds of lupins. Nice. Lupin, this is lupin.
Maybe it isn't on
this one. That's what we're seeing.
And these little guys are cute, too.
Oh,
they
are.
Yeah.
What are these?
I have no idea what that is. Do you know what it is?
Yeah, that's vetch.
That's the vetch.
Yeah.
That's American. Might be The purple ones are vetch.
But this, I don't know.
They're just about gone.
That's another type of vetch.
It is.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Okay, it's
there's
so stocky.
Hundreds of types of vetches.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And how long do they? When do they start coming up? And are they kind of all around at about the same time, or do they have different times that they're blooming?
They have different times. Yeah. There's Mariposa lilies are really cool too. Gorgeous.
Okay, this is Coyote Meadow. This is a picture I submitted.
Yeah.
So you can see that.
See the blue?
Oh,
that's camas.
Oh, okay.
So yesterday, actually, we saw going up to Warner.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's all
that's
over.
That's basically just in that combination.
You'll see some of these meadows that are just solid with it.
Yeah.
And then you go out to these meadows, you'll see scattered flowers. Mm-hmm. These meadows are actually created by man here. Yeah. Because we put irrigation in ditches mm-hmm. on each side.
You were saying something about a wildflower, but I can't remember.
Mariposa lily?
Yes. What are those?
Oh, they're really pretty. Yeah. They gotta.
They're out in the sagebrush, and in end of July, first of August, it's a single stalk flower. It comes up and it's delicate. Very delicate, light lavender. Yes. There's that one right there.
And they don't last very long. There's that low-lying lily too. That what's that one called? With the yellow in the center, and it's only about that high.
You're talking about sand lilies?
Sand lilies, yeah.
They've already been bloomed.
They look like something you'd see in a Japanese painting or something. Just beautiful.
Mariposa,
but they don't last very long. Maybe a couple of weeks, and they're gone. Although lupin is something that you see quite often mm-hmm. through the season.
Oh, that is pretty. Yeah. Are they all pretty small? Are all wildflowers pretty?
No, these are about like that.
We have
the ones that last all summer long. They're called the desert primrose. They're yellow, mm-hmm. real low-lying. And they fold up at night and open up in the daytime.
Keith always says it's not really spring here until he's found buttercups on his hikes.
Well, yeah, but that happens in February and March when you find those buttercups. But they're the first flower to come out. But there's flowers a good share of the year around here, but this time of year is when you have most of them out at once. And I do like the fall and the cooler air, especially after a hot summer. Mm-hmm. And the wild plum leaves get red in the rim rocks, and in October the aspens, of course, turn yellow, and mm-hmm. and so. On a real cold day in the dead of winter is probably my worst time. The rest of the time's okay.
Yeah.
It's good.
Do you have to do a lot of work outside during the winter, or?
Yeah, I feed cows.
Okay.
It depends on the day. If it's really cold and nasty, I get the cows fed and I stoke the fire.
Yeah. What was I going to ask you? Do you all spend much time up in the north part of the county?
Not a lot.
Did when you were taking people around, would you take them?
No, it's just local.
Okay.
There's a rare time that I would haul them up into the Warner Mountains, mm-hmm. and there's a trail. Actually, it's the train trail system, mm-hmm. And ride the crest of the Warners, the North Warners. Yeah. And there's again a good opportunity to see the diversity, because when you're up there, you're in the forest, and with the aspens and with some sagebrush openings and stuff, and then you look towards Heart Mountain down to the Warner Basin in Heart Mountain, then you're looking back at the desert again. So it's ridge of timber, desert, ridge of timber, desert. It's kind of that way. Clearsteins.
Yeah.
They just get further apart, more and more desert as you go east.
Mm-hmm. Where did you grow up?
I grew up on the coast, in Gold Beach.
Okay, on the
Gold
Oregon
Beach
coast.
Rocks. You've heard the.
What's it close to, Gold Beach?
Brookings, south of Coos Bay and North
okay.
Bend. Yeah, it's
okay.
kind of sandwiched in there on the coast, yeah.
So then what was it like when you guys moved out here?
Well, we used to take vacations to the eastern part of the state. And at one point we decided that we liked it so much, why not just go there and live?
Well, we vacationed with horses. Yeah. I mean, that's we hauled our horses and camped and rode.
And our daughter.
And we just kind of thought, well, maybe we can make this work as a business, you know, guest ranching. And so that's where that idea came from, mm-hmm. to do that. Plus, it was when we bought the ranch, we needed a diversification because the ranch wasn't big enough to support a family by on its own raising cattle. It just wasn't. And so we needed that diversification to have the extra income, and it did great.
Hmm. Interesting about that. You don't hear too much about guest ranching here, right here.
No, there's not very many. There's Aspen Ridge. That is for sale now, I guess. They're about had it. And other than that, we were the only ones down here. You had to go up to in the Prineville area. There was a few. Then in northeastern Oregon, there were several up there.
What about wildfires out in this area? Have you?
I've reported a number of them. You know, to get the lightning storms come through here in the summertime. Yeah, we've had fires up here. They never got very big. Fortunately.
Yeah. That's good.
So you've never been directly
No. I as you can see on this hill here, it's a solid rock we're sitting on. There's no soil out there. That's why you don't see much vegetation growing.
Yeah.
You do anything on this little knob here and you need a D8 cat with a ripper to get to make something happen. Including the flat place to put this house. So there's nothing grows. So I don't consider this a high risk area right here for our house, or because, you know, the fire might come up, but it'd be so low and slow moving because of the lack of fuel that it hit some. Even these junipers are going to survive because it doesn't have the ladder fuel to get up to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't worry about that. Other than I would hate to see that burnt, you know.
Yeah. How would I guess I want to hear from both of you guys. How would you just describe this area to someone who's never been here before?
Well, a lot of people I think would call it lonely. This type of a lifestyle where you're so removed from town, especially when you're not working in town. I used to work in town, but that was my fix for the week. But you have to get used to getting in touch with yourself as well as the land in order to be happy out here. I think it's difficult for a lot of people that they don't like the fact that there's, like Keith was saying, people around them all the time and constant stimulation and stuff. So it's a different way to live. And being off the grid, you have to get used to creating your own electricity and living within confines of usage. I mean, there's that. We now have two solar panels out there and a wind generator and backup generator out here that we'll pretty much live like everybody.
But you're off the grid.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So that's our only source of electricity. We're 6 miles nearest power pole.
So
here.
two panels
there. There's two. There's that bigger one and there's a smaller one over here.
Yeah.
That's great. And what about you? How would you describe this?
Well, she's talking about people. I'll talk about the physical of it. And I always describe this as the transition area between the forest and the desert. And see, there's the forest, there's the desert. So that's usually the way I describe it.
Yeah. Can either of you think of anything else you want to say in terms of your personal relationship to the land and its significance? Or?
Well, like I've already mentioned, we consider ourselves stewards of the land. And so I'm very interested in the natural resources. And that's everything, wildlife, grass, forest, rangeland, water, riparian, fish. You know, it all is... It's all in one package here, and we try to manage the land with all that in mind, and that's why we're doing something. This next summer is this creek here, which is gullied partially from that flood I just talked about the first winter we were here. It made a gully down through there, That and the one in 64, the call that we heard of the 64 flood. Mm-hmm. That was the one that initiated it, and this one we had in 96 was the one that just finished it off.
Yeah.
So we're trying, we're going to be doing a creek project out here as long as we can get the state to go along with us,
mm-hmm.
to rehabilitate that. And in doing that, right now we don't have a fishery in that creek. There is some up above us.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the proper type of habitat for fish to survive in. So, and also it dropped the water level, so we're having encroaching dry habitat sagebrush along the creek's edges, and it's displacing the grass and stuff. So we're going to do a project. We actually fill that gully up. There is an old channel. We're going to divert the creek over into the old channel and make it go back to where it came from. And then we're going to be doing some ponds in there for waterfowl habitat, and plus that's where we source for the material to fill the gully up. It's called a pond and plug system, and so that's coming up just hopefully by the end of this summer.
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's a big project.
What stretch? What length?
It's about a mile long. It's okay. Through that total meadow area there. Downstream from that, as you saw coming up, the big gullies that the creek was running in, the huge deep.
Mm-hmm.
Mother Nature did that one. On her own, without man having been involved in it, and that happened hundreds, maybe thousands of years ago. But this is more recent. This is something we can control. That it is what it is. But down below us, then the gulling is not quite so severe. It's healing on its own.
Mm-hmm.
It has area to do that in. We've got the willows coming back in. We've got actually got beavers back in there in some places that are help control the velocity of the water to prevent erosion. And in this, it doesn't have a chance right now. It's just, it would eventually heal itself, but it would probably take out that whole meadow doing it. You know, and width, it's gone down about as far as it's going to go because we're down to really hard pan bedrock type things. Now it's going to start eroding the sides, and it's just going wider and wider and wider.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, it would eventually be just a big basin. And that would be Mother Nature's way of healing that one.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to salvage the meadow, create the fish habitat, by raising the creek level back up to where it historically was. We'll create a water table, a higher water table, that becomes an underground reservoir for downstream. This Willow Creek stops flowing in the summertime every year. It doesn't matter. Every year it stops flowing down there because it's so sandy from the old Lake Shiwakon lake bed,
mm-hmm.
that it just goes down. Mm-hmm. And hopefully this will create enough of a additional supply of water up here that to at least extend that down there.
Uh-huh.
And so, and I'll just kind of describe, I started on that, on the gulling down there. Lake Shiwakon, if you're not familiar with it, it occurred right after the Ice Age, 10,000 years ago.
So it's in the river. It's associated with the river, though.
Well, Lake Shiwakon includes Summer Lake, Abert Lake, basically,
so
all of Paisley, that whole lake.
Area. Okay.
It was some 250 feet deep at a time. They can tell it by they can see the water line along the up on the ridges and
mm-hmm.
stuff. And it went dry a few times. Haymack up
mm-hmm.
and down. Shiwakon River used to go to Summer Lake, but the last time that the Lake Shiwakon was up and went down again, it created a delta. It diverted it to Abert Lake.
Okay.
But anyway. All that area is sediment, and where Willow Creek came into Lake Shiwakon, it created a delta, and so there's a lot of sediment buildup,
mm-hmm.
and that's, you see those rolling hills along that creek that are there, just gentle rolling hills, that's where the delta was. And then when Lake Shiwakon started drying up, going down, well, Willow Creek is coming and it's got to go down. So it starts cutting, mm-hmm. and this is all real soft material. Mm-hmm. It just cuts and cuts and cuts and comes back, and so that's what made that gully.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually had a doctor from USC Berkeley, Dr. Nagera. He studied the geology. He's a geologist. Mm-hmm. Studied this up here, and he's the one who described all that to me.
We had an interesting guess. That we learned as much as they did, I think it was. It was an exchange, which is
so kind anyway, that cool. That's kind of some of the history down there.
Yeah.
And that's
interesting to hear, just specific to this place.
Mm-hmm.
It's really
mm-hmm.
cool.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you wanted to?
Nope. I just like looking out at it.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I don't think we moved away from windows for the first 6 months that we lived here. We just, you know, everywhere you looked, there was pretty. Yeah.
Well, we were in lived in the Cascade Range.
Yeah.
Or, excuse me, coastal range. And you know, the trees around you, you look up, you see a whole sky.
Yeah.
Where and I come
like
here, and I actually timed the planes going across here from horizon to horizon, figuring altitude and speed. I figured I could see 120 miles of sky.
Wow.
From the time they came over this ridge to the time they disappeared over that one, I figured they'd gone 120 miles.
Wow, that's good enough. I'm glad I wondered.
The only thing I was, you asked me how I felt moving here, the only thing I was disappointed in was I could not garden, because the first summer that I tried, we backfilled some terraced beds out there because, like he said, it's hard pan bedrock here. And I put in tomatoes 3 times and they died all 3 times because we had frosts like in 1st of June, middle of July, and then the first one came like the 14th of August or something like that. So he built me a greenhouse, and now I'm happy.
Oh, good. Well, thank you both so much.
Did you get what you wanted?
I think